Well, thank you for coming this morning. We are trying something a little bit different this startup school year. We are not just having our weekly two lectures, but we are having some conversations with notable people. And I couldn't be happier to have one of the most notable startup people here. He'll get embarrassed when I say anything complimentary, so I'll try to avoid it. Paul Graham, my friend and the founder of Y Combinator back in 2005. And we're just going to talk, and hopefully it won't be boring. Paul.
Yes, Jeff.
So you and I got to know each other, strangely, at a, it was kind of a startup at the time, Yahoo, back in the late 90s.
98.
Yeah.
Did you guys know he wrote Yahoo Mail?
Some of it, yeah.
Y Combinator has the people who wrote Yahoo Mail and Gmail.
That is weird, right? Paul Buchheit, who actually has more of a claim on actually writing Gmail than I do have a claim on writing Yahoo Mail. I wrote some important parts of Yahoo Mail, but Paul was kind of by himself doing Gmail almost.
Yeah.
And we were a little more intentional with Yahoo Mail and had a team creating something called Rocket Mail. But it is a little weird that both of us ended up at YC years later. But Paul was at Yahoo. I was at Yahoo because we created something called Rocket Mail and we were purchased in 97. But Paul's company was bought in 98. And so you had this weird idea for a product for something you thought people would want in the mid 90s, which had to do with like SaaS before SaaS was a thing. How did you come up with this idea for ViaWeb, the company that Yahoo bought?
Okay, so what we made was something that is now called a web app. I believe. At the time, it was the first one, and that's why the company was called ViaWeb, because it worked via the web. And the way I remember very vividly, we thought, back then, everybody thought that writing software was identical with writing software that ran on the client. And worse still, for those of you who remember the mid-90s, the client meant Windows, right? And like, we knew how to write software for Unix, and we liked Unix. We did not know how to write software for Windows, but we knew enough to know that we did not want to learn. And so we were really, really highly motivated to figure out how to write software without having to write software to run on Windows. And so we thought to ourselves, well, maybe, well, you know, the way I first thought of it actually was that you would have this, it was an online store builder, right? And I thought that you could send it updates by email. I thought you could send it updates by email, right? And it would change your website. And then I remember thinking, well, if you
Postgres for shopping carts or whatever.
If you can use SMTP, why not HTTP to update your website? Whoa, the software could run on the server and you could control it by clicking on links in the browser. Would that even work, right? But I remember I was like sleeping on a mattress on the floor in Robert's spare bedroom. And I remember I sat up in bed when I thought of this, like the letter L, right? It was actually like one of those scenes in a movie. I'm like, oh my God, we could avoid having to write software on Windows at all. We were never thinking about the benefits of web apps, which are great, as it turned out. We were just thinking we could like actually do this without ever having to learn.
So it was all about
Windows.
Avoiding Windows. It didn't matter that like you could deploy then without having to ship software. None of that occurred to you.
No.
It was just like, avoiding Windows.
We could actually write
Thank
this
you,
code
Bill Gates.
Never have to learn Windows. Because like the Netscape people had already gone through the pain of making Netscape work on Windows, right? And we could just like that was like a hole onto Windows. You know, and people could get through the hole and click on links in the browser and control the software. And so we weren't even sure this would work because it was so weird. But we immediately sat down and tried to write this really, really clunky website builder that worked by clicking on links. It was terrible, but it did actually work. It could make a website. And I'm like, holy shit, this actually works.
Yeah, it's weird that like an innovative idea like that just sort of comes out of nowhere. I mean, it doesn't seem innovative now because like all websites work that way, but the first one, like that's going from zero to one. How do you like?
It's very common.
Has to happen,
it's
right?
Very common for ideas. In retrospect, they seem obvious, and you sort of historians who weren't there sort of straighten out all the kinks in the development, and it just seems like oh, they had this. You know, it's like this idea. I always hate it when people represent startup ideas as light bulbs. You know, because as well as being the most cliched metaphor imaginable, it's also false. You don't just like have this idea and then realize it, right? No, it's more like you have this sort of inkling that something you could do something that somebody else hasn't done before. And it's probably a bad idea, but you're too lazy to learn Windows, and so you want to do it that way, right? Or like Zuck starting Facebook, you know, just like, let's see what happens, right? It's way implausible that this would ever be a startup.
Which is good for you all. Hopefully some of your ideas seem really implausible, right?
I love it when ideas seem implausible in the right way. Over the years, I mean, I already had, just from being a hacker, as sort of a good nose for this sort of thing, but it has become refined over all these years of dealing with startups. And when people have, I was talking to some people yesterday and they were talking about two possible things they could do. And one of them seemed like naughty. Not like it was sort of maltreating anyone. It was just sort of taking advantage of something that seemed like it shouldn't even be possible. Right, like making the software run on the server and just like never making software that seemed to the users to run on their computer, but actually was just talking to them through the browser. That kind of naughtiness. And then I said, like, pick that one because it seems so outrageous. It seems so hilarious.
It seems like there's all these ways we have talking about what's a good idea, and when you try to match up ideas with them, it's always sort of a complicated. It's like, is this idea naughty or is it like not quite intuitive or not so obvious? And it's really always hard to take any particular idea and say, is that the one with potential?
Well, you can't tell. In fact, that's another thing. It's not just that the outcomes of startups are hard to predict. I think to some degree, they're actually indeterminate. There's a huge amount of luck involved, you know? And so I think even if Y Combinator were as good at picking startups as you could possibly get. I mean, in fact, you have like 150 startups per batch, of which maybe five will become giant or something like that.
Hopefully five. That would be good.
Yeah. Well, it depends on your definition of giant, right? It's a power law distribution. More like if for some definitions of giant, one every five batches.
We'll take if five or any definition of giant, yeah. We'll be happy.
So what was I saying?
We're talking about
indeterminacy of ideas.
Even if
you were able to pick perfectly, that doesn't mean you could get the batches down to only five startups. You'd probably have to pick 20, I think, even if you were perfect.
So it's hard. Like it's hard to know. There's a strange mix of extraordinary hard work, an idea that actually has something to it but is not obvious.
It's hard for founders to know.
Yeah.
You don't know yourselves. You don't know yourselves. I mean, you don't know, comma, yourselves. Not that you don't know yourselves, although that's also true. and that's why it's good to be a hacker. Because if you're some business person, you know, and you think, I am going to work on business opportunities, right? Well, I don't know if this is a business opportunity, so I'm not going to work on it. Whereas someone who's a hacker, who's just doing things for the fun of it,
or because they don't like Windows.
Right. Well, yeah. Laziness, too.
Laziness is actually, in some cases, really helpful.
Some
kinds of laziness.
I'm a little scared about this meme escaping into the wild.
Right.
Can't you just see?
Well,
It's
true. Like,
they said laziness is good, he said from the sofa as he ate another donut. You know? It would be better if people thought laziness wasn't good, because the laziness that kind of that people do that's good, they would do anyway, even if they thought
it's weird. Being lazy was bad. Yeah, well, using laziness not in the normal sense of laziness, right? Because if you're there's no such thing as a lazy founder that builds a big company. There's a certain sort of. It's sort of a reticence to do something for some reason. We're calling it laziness,
avoiding,
but it's not really.
Like, that seem like gratuitous schleps.
Yeah.
It makes you, you know, if you have a natural hatred for gratuitous schleps, like, then what that produces elegant solutions.
So in 1995-ish, I was like trying every single idea I could possibly try to start some internet business. And I was doing it all by myself, which was awful. And what I didn't know how to do was to find people to do it with. And I kind of ran into a bunch of people, and I had no clue whether they would be good people to start companies with. And I was thinking about your experience. You said you were like sleeping on Robert's floor. You started ViaWeb with two fascinating people, Robert Maxwell and Trevor Blackwell, Robert Morris and Trevor Blackwell. Robert Morris and Trevor Blackwell. And that was a weird mix of names. Anyway, how did you pick them as co-founders? How did that happen? And when did you decide they would be good co-founders?
Were they good co-founders? All right. So
yeah, right?
Well, they were extremely
it worked.
They were extremely truculent co-founders who were very good at programming. But I remember Robert was like not into the whole startup thing the entire way. Like whenever he was on the board, and whenever you get an acquisition offer, the board has to at least consider it, right? And so we would get these crap lowball acquisition offers. We'll give you like $2 million in our stock, right?
And Robert was like, yes.
No. Robert would say, like, we would vote on it. And Robert would always say, well, you know, I have to be honest here. Like, this would at least mean we could stop working on this thing. And so, yeah. Yes, I would take this deal, right? I made a deal with Robert that if he ever made $1 million out of ViaWeb, he would get an earring. Robert is not the kind of guy who would enjoy having an earring, let me tell you. And so as soon as the deal closed, me and Trevor frog marched him to the place in Harvard Square where people get their things pierced.
Never heard this before.
And we got him an earring. There's photographs on the internet of Robert Morris with an earring.
I bet he didn't keep it.
Not for long. We should have specified that. I never thought to specify.
You never thought you'd actually get $1 million.
No, I really actually did, but I thought he would wear it for a bit longer. When his fiance saw it, she fell on the floor. I chose Robert because he was my co-conspirator in everything. And I don't mean I was always the lead, and he was just the co-conspirator. When he did things, I would be his co-conspirator too. So, like the internet worm of 1988.
Yeah, do you guys know Robert Morris is pretty famous all on his own?
Yeah, he invented buffer overflow. And I remember when he told me about it, and I said, "Wow, what a cool idea! You should totally do that."
He was the first famous hacker who really got in trouble, I think.
Yeah,
really in trouble.
He was the way. It's true. He was the first person to be prosecuted under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act of 1986. Which,
so if you're looking for a co-founder, look at people who've been prosecuted because it works.
Yeah, he is actually a convicted felon.
This is another meme we don't necessarily want to escape out there, that convicted felons are what you want to look for as co-founders.
If they're convicted for that, it was funny because the FBI, like law enforcement kind of does things by the book, right? Like imagination is a big thing in like Sherlock Holmes stories, but not in actual everyday law enforcement. And so they have these, the FBI agent told me, like, they have these motive they look for: sex, drugs, money, revenge, right? And so like Robert did it out of curiosity, and that just like, it was just not on the list, right? They really had a hard time figuring out what the hell was going on. I think even within the government, there were lots of people who never understood what was going on.
So back to Robert and Trevor, who?
Oh, so why did I pick Robert and Trevor?
Yeah.
So Robert I picked because I would do everything with him, right? We had all these schemes. And
so you knew you could work with him.
I knew I could work with him, and I knew he was really good. He was a really good programmer. He could program as fast as he could type. Of course, this was in C, which is a lot of very verbose language. But he could program as fast as he could type. He was amazing. He would, like, if he didn't like what the operating system would do, he would edit the source and recompile it, and then it would do what he wanted.
So truculence aside, he was exceptional.
Like, when he showed up at Harvard, undergrads were only allowed to have accounts on, like, the official undergrad computing system off in the science center. And there were all these real computers in the CS department in the Aiken lab. And so they wouldn't give him an account there. And so he just walked up to a machine, switched it to single user with him as the super user, gave himself an account, and then switched it back. Right.
He was curious.
All. Yeah. Well, he also wanted accounts on the right machines. He got kicked. This whole thing will be about Robert. Robert's such an interesting character. I shouldn't talk about this.
He may be more interesting than anything else we can talk about.
He got kicked out of Harvard as an undergrad for reconnecting Harvard to the internet. Harvard had been one of the early internet nodes.
Doesn't that sound funny to like get in trouble for disconnecting a school from the internet?
No, connecting it.
For connecting a school to the internet?
Okay. Where were we?
We're still trying to figure out why the heck you chose Robert and Trevor.
I should tell you, though, about how he reconnected.
Oh, to tell us about the disconnecting.
I'll make it really fast.
No, it's okay.
So
we have all day.
We don't, do we?
No, we don't.
Okay, how long do we have?
We have enough time.
We have the same watch.
More or less.
Robert. Harvard was one of the very early internet nodes. And by the time Robert arrived as an undergrad, the connection had died from bit decay. Like, no one noticed. that's how unimportant the internet was back then, or rather ARPANET, as it was then called.
Yeah, barely an internet, right?
And so RTM spent one whole semester working on getting Harvard reconnected to
RTM
the internet.
RTM is Robert's.
Yes, Robert. And he didn't do any work for any of his classes, and he got such bad grades he got kicked out for a year. So we actually used that later as a recruiting technique because we knew that because there might be other people who got kicked out for spending all their time on some project. And so we actually went around Harvard and posted up this poster saying, did you get kicked out for working on some project of your own? We'd like to hire you.
I think there's probably something.
And we got a really good programmer that way.
There's probably something.
He made tons of money off of options because we got acquired during the year, right? And he enjoyed life out of school so much, I don't think he went back until he was 25. All right. So why Trevor?
Well, so you picked Robert. Robert was the guy you did everything with, and he was great.
Okay. So after we'd been doing,
but by the way, when you picked Robert, did you know he was going to be a pain in the ass in so many ways as you like, or was that a surprise to you?
Well, I knew he was a pain in the ass. I didn't know the company was going to be so hard and that would bring out so much pain in the ass.
So you didn't realize how hard startups were?
Well, let me tell you, the way we got Trevor was very indicative.
Yeah.
So a month in, we'd been working on this company for a month. And Robert rebels, and he says, we've been working on this company for a whole month, and it's still not done. what have you gotten me into, right? And I thought, maybe we need more programmers. And so I said, all right, Robert, who's the smartest person you know in grad school? And he said, Trevor, right? And I said, Trevor, right? Trevor's one of those people who's a lot smarter than he seems. Trevor is actually super smart. And so we went and recruited Trevor. And he said, oh, okay. that's a really good Trevor imitation.
That almost sounded
actually.
Canadian.
Trevor has two modes. Oh, okay. And oh, I'm sorry. which is what he does when he does something that breaks everything, which was very common, very common. And so we got Trevor. I recruited Trevor to work on the thing. He does nothing for 2 weeks, at least as far as I can tell. He just disappears. And then 2 weeks later, he says, come into my office. And he's rewritten all our goddamn software in Smalltalk, you know? is that typical?
Yes.
So I said, all right, Trevor, we're not using that, but do this instead. right? And so Trevor was like this super productive hacking monster.
But you didn't know that in advance. You just trusted Robert when Robert told you he was really smart.
Well, if Robert said he was the smartest, he's definitely the smartest.
But there's kind of a deep lesson in that, and how you pick, whether it's employees or co-founders, it's you find someone you trust and then find someone they trust.
Yeah, although here's an interesting point. That works better for some qualities than others. Like intelligence, intelligent people can judge other intelligent people, but trustworthy people cannot judge other trustworthy people. In fact, trustworthy people are often fooled by untrustworthy people. So like Kate Courteau is like our architect who did this is like super trustworthy, but she's always fooled by these like sneaky schemers, you know, who take advantage of her.
So I guess that means you take recommendations from people, but then you have to add your own.
No. You can totally trust. Like if Robert says someone's smart and I disagree, I think I must be wrong. Right.
Yeah, but you need to.
It just works for some qualities better than others.
But,
this whole
but you want them to be trustworthy when they join you as a co-founder. So you have to add that judgment
for
on
trustworthiness.
Top.
Yes. This whole thing of like networking doesn't work. It doesn't. You have to have someone who can judge whether people are trustworthy, which I am not even good at. I am not good at. The person who does that for Y Combinator is Jessica, the social radar, the secret power behind everything.
So you did hire people via Web 2.
Yes.
What did you learn about hiring in your first startup? Like, so you learned that they if they were getting lousy grades because they were working on a project, that seemed good, which is kind of counterintuitive. A lot of things we seem to do at YC end up being counterintuitive.
Startups in general are very, very counterintuitive. And so that's actually why YC exists. If it was obvious what to do in starting a startup, YC couldn't really add much by teaching people how to do it, right? And so I often, in fact, practically every day if I do office hours, I'm reminded of this, that like what Y Combinator does is tell founders things that they ignore, right? So we tell people, don't hire too fast. And then they go off and hire too fast. And then they come back later and say, oh, I wish we'd listened. But like, all the things we tell people the counterintuitive stuff, not the obvious stuff. And then what counterintuitive means is it sounds wrong. And so they go with their gut and do the wrong thing instead. And then hopefully catch the mistake in time.
Why is it that startups are so counterintuitive?
You know, that would be very much writing an essay about. That would be worth writing an essay about why startups are so counterintuitive. I don't know. I could come up with some theories, but I have a feeling the answer is so interestingly complicated, I would be unlikely to come up with
it. I mean, it's really interesting. We were just talking about one of the things that you did write an essay about, which is somewhat counterintuitive. When you start a startup and you're like, okay, now I'm going to grow. And then you write a whole bunch of stuff, about, like you're writing software that helps you grow. And you wrote a whole essay that says, don't do that. Do things that don't scale.
In the beginning, yeah. Do things that don't scale. Because growth is measured.
Well, maybe you can start by saying what it means to do things that don't scale. Because I don't know if you guys have read this essay.
You have not all read?
I'm sure you've all read all of Paul's essay. But this is actually very important because most of you all have early startups. And when you do an early startup, it's become our mantra, YC, and I've seen it again and again. You should not try to do too much in the beginning. You should do things that don't scale.
Well, what doing things that don't scale means specifically is doing things in a sort of handmade, artisanal, painstaking way that you feel like, yeah, it would be great if you could do things that way forever. But you're in the back of your mind, you think to yourself, well, there's no way we could keep doing this and become giant, right? And what do things that don't scale means is do those things early on anyway, because you know, if you don't do them, you'll never be big, so you got nothing to lose. And also, you learn a lot from it. You learn a lot. And so I discovered a lot of these things that we teach startups at Y Combinator, or you teach startups at Y Combinator. I'm retired. I don't know if you know that. But a lot of things you guys teach startups are things that I hit myself and didn't realize that they were actually common startup lessons. So one of them is doing things very manually for your early customers. Like, it's so important to get early customers that if you have to do a ton of manual stuff, that's okay. You'll learn a lot from it.
Did you guys do manual stuff?
Yes, totally. And we thought, oh, we're doing it wrong. This is so lame. And in fact, it was exactly the right thing. We made an online store builder. You could build a store on the internet and sell stuff. And we would go to would-be customers and say, would you like to use our easy online store builder? And they would say, no. and we would say, but you want an online store, right? And they would say, yeah. And they would say, well, what if we used our software for you to make an online store, and then you could have it? Would that be good? And they'd say, all right. And so we'd like, we can't get anyone to use our software, but at least they're willing to let us use it for them. and it seemed so lame. I learned so much shit about, like, direct marketing, as it turns out it's called. We were members of the DMA, the Direct Marketing Association. That's what, you know, in every business.
Card-carrying member of the DMA.
We were. In every business, they have a name for the business that's not the name outsiders call it. Like fast food. No, they don't call it that. They call it fast casual within the industry, right? And in the catalog business, they used to call the direct marketing industry, right? So that's what the DMA meant back in those days, the catalog business. We signed up for every catalog. You know those catalogs you get in the mail? We would just like write and ask for more. We had this like bookshelf full of every catalog ever.
Yeah, it seems like almost like if you were building a new search engine, what you ought to do is have your box out there and then just take all the searches manually and like get results and throw them out there and see what happens. I'm trying to think what we did for mail that was manual in the beginning. We had sort of a manual ad server. Like, we didn't really have ad serving technology. We just throw ad, like, I wrote it, so it wasn't really good. Mm. And we would just throw them in there. There's a deep lesson there for people, though. Like, what happens if you think you know the solution and you build lots of stuff for it, you're going to be wrong because you just don't know it.
Having to use our software myself made it much better, because I would be using our software to make someone's website, right? And I was also the guy who wrote the site builder. And so I would be using it and think to myself, this is inconvenient. I'd like go and in the middle of building their site, I would change the software. And I mean, ship as in like MV. And that's the great thing about server-based software. Ship is the Unix MV command. CP. I would want to keep a copy of the source
CP,
so I could keep editing. I would like change the software in the middle of using it, and then go back to working on their website. And boy, did that make that made the software much better that I had to use it.
Yeah. So picking co-founders. You want to pick the best people who you can somehow believe are trustworthy. It's probably helpful for a lot of people. I think a lot of people taking the class are sole founders now.
Yeah.
Why is it that sole founders, that being a sole founder is so difficult?
Wow. There's so many different reasons. Like, I think the hardest part is morale. If you have multiple people, they keep one another going when things are going badly, and there's no one to cheer you up.
That's what was hard for me. I remember 95, I'd be like, I know this internet thing's going to be real, but damn.
Oh, so you were a sole founder.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why his hair is grayer than mine.
Being a sole founder is hard. Like, it's hard because there's a million reasons why what you're doing isn't going to work, and mostly you're right. So it's easy to convince yourself Paul used to say, look, you have two choices as a founder. Do you remember what you would say after that?
Well, there are so many different cases.
There's versions of this. Well, he would say you could either quit or get rich.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, die or get rich. Like the company,
he has a lot of versions.
That's what happens with startups. Mostly, the company either dies or it
something
succeeds.
Works.
And if it succeeds, you get rich.
And you know, getting rich can mean you have a nice little business where you're the boss and you have 20 or 50 employees, or it could mean you're Airbnb, right? They're both good outcomes. Not as good for your investors necessarily, but for you, they're really good. And doing things that don't scale, that's, you know, and internalizing what that really means. I was thinking about, you know, one of the, it's the sort of a things that don't scale that we talk about at YC all the time. We say you're supposed to, for success, you talk to users and write code. Right. You talked, and if you think about it, talking to users, especially as sort of the founder, doesn't really scale very well. But that's what it forces you to do. If you have to do everything that doesn't scale, it forces you to learn.
Right. In the beginning, you only have 10 customers. You want to grow 20%. You want to grow 10% next week. 10% a week is an ambitious goal. You only got to get one more customer. You can go out and do that very manually, right? And then next week, you have 11 customers. You have to get 1.1 customers, right? Which is basically one, right? You just keep going out there and doing things manually. And as long as your growth rate is good, it doesn't matter how small the number is, because a constant growth rate means exponential growth, and that means the base number will soon take care of itself.
I was kind of thinking about what makes companies good and what makes companies fail. And I was thinking about maybe how we could talk a little bit about some of those aspects of how people can kind of figure out how they're doing here. We have thousands of companies out in startup school land trying to figure out what to do next and whether they're doing the right thing and whether they're failing and whether they're on the right path.
What makes companies fail most of the time is poor execution by the founders, right? We often talk to startups who are worried about competitors. And one good one advantage of YC having funded so many companies is you have a really large data set. And like, how many companies have been killed by competitors? One? More than one, like out of 1,900, right? I tell startups that basically you have the same protection against competitors that light aircraft have against crashing into other light aircraft when flying through clouds. You know what the protection is? Space is large. Right? Those little Cessnas don't have any radar in them. You know, you can't see in clouds.
This falls under the rubric of counterintuitive advice, because one of the things that happens all the time is people come up to me and say, oh my God, there's another new company. What should I, you know, that's in exactly my space. What should I do?
Right. And it's sort of like if you're running the 100 meters, right, and suddenly there appears another lane with another runner in it, what should you do? Run as fast as you can, just like you presumably were, right? If they're better than you, they'll win. And if not, then you'll win.
And that's a good reminder. Could everyone please silence your phones if you haven't already? What else? Like one of the things we do a lot is try to judge, right? Companies and founders
and
pick who's going to succeed. And you guys are doing the same thing, you know, except you're trying to pick yourselves, hopefully. What is it that
makes startups succeed?
That makes startups succeed.
Well, you have to start with a good founding team, ideally, not just one person.
That's my question.
You can do it with one person.
Well, I couldn't. I couldn't. I ended up having to join other people. I actually think vast majority.
You tried, that was not rocket mail that you were.
No, saying. I was. Okay, no, okay. There's no way. Like I couldn't do it. I'm not built that way. I think most people aren't built that way. That's my questions about Robert and Trevor. That, you know, it's just so difficult.
I would not try and start a startup just with myself as the founder.
Hmm.
I don't think I could do it.
Yeah, it's maybe lonely enough anyway.
You think you can, but I couldn't. So you need a good, solid founding team who know one another well and who can work together.
Just like pause there. Like knowing one another well, why does that even matter?
Because what happens in a startup will shake your relationship. If there's any sort of flakiness or uncertainty or disloyalty or whatever, like lingering in there, it will emerge under the stresses of a startup.
Yeah. It's like a marriage, only harder. You spend more time with that
person. There's other differences.
There's potentially, yeah. Okay, so you get a good founding team. You get someone who you can stand stress with.
So there's two categories of stuff. There's two categories of answers we could give here. Like, there's the answer you give to investors about how to pick startups. And there's the, and then there's like only a subset of that is useful to founders, right?
Right.
So like if you know, you could tell investors you want to pick smart people, right? But founders are as smart as they are if they've already, what can we tell them? Get smarter, right? And actually it turns out it's not that important to be smart. It's much, much more important to be determined. If you imagine this hypothetical person who's like 100 out of 100 for smart and 100 out of 100 for determination, right? And then you start taking away determination. You know, it doesn't take very long before you have this sort of ineffectual but brilliant person. Whereas if you take someone who's like super, super determined and you start taking away smartness bit by bit, I mean, eventually you get to some guy who owns a lot of taxi medallions, but he's still rich, right? Or like a trash hauling business or something like that. But like, you can take away a lot of smart.
Yeah, you have to take a lot of smart and take away a bunch of ethics at the same time, and then you get that guy, right?
He can be president.
Yeah. I've been thinking about like
who thought that would Trump would actually teach an important lesson?
Yeah, for know? Startups.
It's all about determination.
I was thinking about these axes we think about, and those are two, like the intelligence axis and the determination axis. And obviously, if you were really intelligent, really determined, that's awesome.
By the way, only one person has to be super determined.
Right.
Right. So like, you know, you can have one person who really wants to start the company, and
like
one person.
You and Robert.
Right, exactly. Who after a month is like, what? We're still working on
but
this?
But that depends on this tight bond where you can drag that person along with you. Otherwise, they'll go away. But I was thinking there's actually another axis, which is you have to have the ability somewhere on your team to project, to think up, because your idea is going to suck. And then it'll suck less and less. And so you have to have the ability to think, where should we like to navigate? Like, you have to have some sort of creativity that allows you to like make the right choices.
No, actually, you might not have to be that creative. If you care enough about users, you can just follow what will make users happy the way a scientist follows the truth. And eventually, without much thinking on your part, the need to grow will give you this product idea that's actually the product, that's the result of evolution.
So maybe you're either sort of Steve Jobs and can intuit what customers need, or you just have to have the skill of actually talking to customers and understanding what they're saying, which isn't always obvious.
Well, you know, Steve Jobs's trick was he satisfied users too, except he was the user. It's like, I don't want to have any phone jack anymore, so no more phone jacks for anybody, right?
And maybe he was just lucky that his desires were generic enough that it was true
close
for
enough.
Everybody.
Yeah. He was living in the future.
Yeah. He didn't really like the internet except for reading the New York Times, so he never really got that right.
Interesting. You worked at Apple at one point after you got bought.
I did for six months.
What was it like? What was Steve like? Could you tell from where you were in Apple what Steve was like?
Yeah, I got to talk to him a few times. He's different.
Tell us how. Are there useful lessons you can learn from him, or is he a one-off?
I wouldn't presume. I only met with him a handful of times, and I wouldn't presume to know too much about him.
Yeah, but you had a lot of indirect evidence and stories and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like, do you ever see founders at YC? You think to yourself, ooh, this is like Steve Jobs.
Yeah, I don't think we'd fund a Steve Jobs at YC.
Well, that's not good.
Yeah. And the reason is, especially when Steve Jobs was starting off, he was an asshole.
Oh, I think actually you would fund him because Steve Jobs would make you fund him.
Maybe.
Right?
Maybe. We try to avoid people who seem like they're assholes. And I think, like, and like we like, you know, you wrote a whole essay on being nice.
Yeah.
The Ronco principle, right?
There's a couple.
A couple.
One is about
that. Being nice.
There's also
yeah.
one called Be Good.
Be Good, right. And I don't think he would have passed the test, especially when he was younger. Which is, I worry about that because it's true that it's usually good to be nice and friendly and benevolent. He wasn't.
Maybe if YC had caught him early.
We could have helped.
Maybe.
But maybe that was
maybe.
Part of, maybe that's part of what made him successful in the beginning. I don't know.
I don't know.
It worked for Donald Trump.
Donald
or
Trump.
Did it.
That's a different kind
that's
of business.
That's a bad example, right?
Yeah.
This Donald is another
Trump
meme
is an
we should
example.
Avoid.
No, well, like in business, determination matters more, but like business is not identical with startups.
I want to leave these guys some time to ask questions, but I want like, what are they going to get wrong? What mistakes will these people make that maybe hearing them might help? It probably won't because you won't listen, but.
Yeah. What you will get wrong is that you will not pay enough attention to users. You will make up some idea in your own head that you will call your vision. And then you will spend a lot of time thinking about your vision in a cafe by yourself and build some elaborate thing without going and talking to users because that's doing sales, which is a pain in the ass, and they might say no. And you'd be way better off finding someone, anyone who has a problem that they will pay you to fix and fixing it and then seeing if you can find more people like that. Best case is if you yourself have the problem, right? But like you will not ship fast enough because you don't want to face you're embarrassed to ship something unfinished and you don't want to face the likely feedback that you will get from shipping.
It's humbling and humiliating when they tell you how shitty what you built actually is. Right? But that's the only way you get it better.
Yeah. So you will shrink from contact with the real world or contact with your users. That's the mistake you will make.
Yeah, there's a Paul Grahamism in there, which is all around launching fast, launching before you're ready. I sometimes tell people the story of...
It's Reid Hoffman, actually, who harped on that one early, not me. I think he said, if you're not embarrassed with what you launched,
right.
Then you launch too late.
I remember when I was joining Y Combinator, and at the same time, this is not necessarily a good idea, launching Imagine K-12, this ed tech version of YC, and I came in to talk to Paul, and he's like, "So, how's it going with Imagine K-12?" Because he helped out a lot. And I said, "Oh, it's going well."
I think it was probably called something else at that point.
Well, no. It was by then you'd already, he actually gave us the name of Imagine K-12. And so it was called Imagine K-12. And it's like, "When are you going to launch?" And I was like, "Well, working on our PR plan and we're finishing the software." So this was like, you know, we're going to have a summer batch. And this was probably in February or something. And I said, "So we have, you know, like, you know, probably in like 6 weeks." He said, "Why don't you just launch? Why don't you just launch now?" And I was like, "Damn, he just did it to me." Mm. And we did. We launched like within a week. We launched, and so that is a mistake you'll make. You'll wait too long. You'll be embarrassed.
We launched YC probably in less than a week of having the idea. Of course, launching it was merely posting a website and. And we didn't have any software in the beginning. We just had this ASCII form that people would fill out and reply to us by email. The first couple batches, the applications were by email. We would print them out and pass them around amongst the partners. And like we would all write grades on the top, like we were grading papers. And then we would sort this heap of papers, and that was the application process.
Talking about doing things that don't scale. Try to do that with thousands of applications now, it would be harder. So we have lots of software that does that, because eventually you scale.
Yeah.
Eventually you build software when you learn what software you ought to be building. It'd be fun to spend a lot of time, more time, talking about how YC got started. But I think rather than that, let's...
How much time do you have left?
we can probably go to around 12. All videos that get too long are like no one wants to watch anyway. So, so we've already been going for about 40 minutes or so. So let's open it up to any questions you guys might have. Yeah.
My question is about hiring co-founders. So in the complex pieces, most likely you have a lot of very successful friends that might want to join you and you can work with them and build something. But you're risking losing basically that person. And if you want to hire someone from the street who's a co-founder and who's technically savvy, then you might risk breaking the company later. You know, so it's kind of like sometimes it's more risk. Actually.
Are you saying that if you recruit your co-founders or your friends as co-founders, you might lose them as friends?
I don't think
that's a big danger. I don't think you have to.
So the question was, should I have my friends be co-founders and then maybe risk losing them as friends, or should I just take someone off the street where I don't have the risk of losing them as friends, but they might break my company? Was that your question? Did I get that right?
I already answered it, dude. Come on.
I just wanted to make sure they heard the question, too, because
I repeated the question.
Yes, go ahead.
How do you deal with different... So I guess it's a two-part question. One is, how do you deal with different commitment levels between co-founders? And also, if you had to fire a co-founder, how would you go about it?
How do you deal with different commitment levels of co-founders? And if you do have to fire a co-founder, what should you do?
Okay, so the way you deal with different commitment levels is you ask yourself, would I rather have 30% of this person or 100% of some other person? And in my case, I would rather have like 10% of Robert Morris's brain than 100% of almost anybody else's. So it was an easy decision. How do you fire co-founders? In Y Combinator, the answer is you ask Carolyn Levy. Y Combinator there's so much experience with dealing with crap like firing co-founders, and like you just go and talk to them and they say, here, you do this and this and this, right?
And it's probably online too, so you could Google it.
Really? Has YC published how to fire co-founders?
We've actually, if you look at some of the talks Carolyn has given and Kirstie, I'm pretty sure they've covered that particular issue. One way you deal with it, by the way, is making sure that someone has a little bit more stock, perhaps. It's usually better to have somewhat equal shares, not completely equal. And if one person has 51% and the other person has 49%, then they can
you at least
control.
Don't get deadlocked.
Yes.
Yeah. So when you talk about launch, is launching to like private beta or a couple of people good enough, or do you have to just launch it to public?
So what does launch really mean?
It means you have actually, okay, so the question is launching in a private beta to a few people good enough, or you'd have to launch the general public? I will take launching in just a private beta to a couple people, because that's closer to full launch than like just sitting thinking of your idea in a cafe.
Yeah.
Next. Yes.
What do you think about the current, fundraising and project structure of like crypto projects, where a bunch of projects have maybe like overrates or basically the.
Are you asking about ICOs? Yeah. What do you think about ICOs, Paul?
I know nothing about this world. I've heard there's a huge amount of crypto money floating around. If there's money floating around, it's often a good idea for startups to try and get it. Beyond that, I don't know.
But I will say, like, one of the things we've seen a lot at Y Combinator is it's not always right to raise too much money. And even if you don't, ICO thing.
By definition of two, it's always wrong.
Yeah. I'll raise a lot of money. And the thing about, there's a couple reasons for that. Is one, you dilute more than you necessarily need to. But the other reason is that money just sitting there has sort of a gravitational effect.
It makes
you spend it
fat.
And it makes you do stupid things. So it's like there's companies that have raised $1 billion on ICOs, and I don't know if they'll ever have a real company.
Where you get a bunch of LPs and raise $1 billion, and then you just hire so many more people than you actually need.
Right.
It's usually high equity, though. It's
usually not a...
That's what I was saying. That's the difference with an ICO. I get it. But just having $1 billion when you only barely have an idea is not necessarily, like, you know, Magic Leap raised $2.3 billion and they seem to have almost nothing.
By the way, that is the trick for getting your question answered. I learned that a long time ago. You raise your hand as you're as people are finishing the preceding question. And I see that guy's hand over there. He knows the trick. Go ahead. What is it?
What are your best tips for a great user interview?
My best tips for a great user interview? Well, you want to figure out not just what they think is wrong, but what's actually wrong, like what's missing in their life, right? So just start talking to them, like, say, what would you like to do? What would you like to be able to do that you can't? And they might just, you know, they'll tend to give you an answer that's like a subset, right? Like, you know, if you were asking someone about email, they'd like to say, I like, you know, I'm. It's really important to me to be able to mark emails as unread, right? And like, what does it mean, unread? That whole unread thing is a sign that the whole inbox is being misused. It's what's really going on is it's a to-do list, you know, and that's why you have to mark items as unread so they stay on your to-do list. And so you start asking them with what's wrong, and then you try and figure out what they really mean, what they're really getting at, which they themselves might not know. You know, and then you start asking them, so what if you could do such and such? What if you could do such and such, right? So start by asking them questions about their life and then get hypothetical on them. Okay, we should ask someone on this side.
Well, you've taken over, so you just keep calling them. You're doing great. Go ahead.
All right. Right there in the way corner.
Love it. This is actually kind of off one of the questions that somebody else asked earlier. So you talked about launching early, right? How do you justify the financial risk and turbulence because of launching a shitty product?
How do you justify the financial risk of launching a shitty product?
Or an early stage product or something half-baked, right?
Okay, so the risk of launching early is not as great as the risk of launching late. It's not like there's only risk on one side, right? There's a risk of launching late, too. So you got to have a rule of thumb about when to launch. And my rule of thumb... the way I have this phrase for it that didn't become as sticky as minimum viable product because it describes what the minimum viable product has. But it's a quantum of utility, right? Launch as soon as you have a quantum of utility, which means as soon as there's one person in the world who is glad that you launched because now they can do something that they couldn't do. If you have something that if you launched it, no one would be happy, then you're not ready to launch, right? As soon as there's at least somebody out there who would say, oh, here's this thing I can use because I can do X and before that I couldn't do it, then you should launch. As soon as you have a quantum of utility.
It sounds like there's some utility function. Like if it makes too many people happy and like one person happy and like 100 really unhappy, maybe it's not ready. But if you know, Paul Buchheit always says, if you have 10 people who really love your product, that's a good place to be.
Yeah, all you need is, if there's 10 people who are super excited, totally, totally launch. And nobody else cares. That is perfectly fine. That's great. Okay, yes.
Can you talk about the difference between you always say build what customers want, where one says build what customers need. So most of the time, the want may be very short-sighted, whereas the need may be deeper, or want may have some unintended consequences. So how do you deal with building what they really need versus what they really want?
Well, the danger of building... Okay, so the question is, how do you decide between building what people need and building what people want, right? Well, the problem is... what you really want to be doing is build something people will choose to use or buy or become your user or something like that. And so here's a counterexample to the whole need versus want thing. What people need is healthy food. What people buy is unhealthy food. So if you're a business, which one do you want to do, right? I mean, yeah, ideally, you want to make healthy food that also tastes good, right? But really... You can't push this too far. You can't push this too far. I mean, I myself would not start some company making junk food or something like that. But if you are making food, don't like, or something where need and want are very different, be real careful about picking need, you know, or you'll go out and, you know, your goal will be to cleanse the world of sin or something like that.
Yeah, it's easy to delude yourself as a founder to think you're like you're.
Yeah, the other danger is what they need is what you think they need. What you're right. implicitly talking about is what you think they need. Cleanse the world of your definition of sin, right? Yes. Yeah.
My name is Mr. I'm working on smart wearable technologies. My question is, when I'm working my project, sometimes I'm seeing different problems and different, you know, my mind is thinking different solutions. Is that normal as a founder? And
is it normal as a founder to see multiple different solutions? Yeah, sure, absolutely. You just have to pick one. Pick the one that you think could get usage quickest.
And what's the founder DNA?
What's the founder DNA?
Founder DNA.
Founder DNA.
Founder's DNA. I mean, basically, character and.
You mean what makes someone a founder?
Yes.
They choose to be one.
And what's your explanation?
What makes someone a good founder? A combination of positive and negative things, I think. Positive things are things like determination and, you know, willingness to try new things. But then there may also be negative things. Like if you are... I think if you have worked for a large company for 20 years, you might not be a founder unless you were forced to for visa reasons. Because if you were the kind of person that would make a good founder, you wouldn't be able to stand working for a large company for 20 years, right? And so actually we've noticed certain companies where the alumni of these companies tend to make bad founders. And it's because no one who would make a good founder could have stood working for these companies for very long. Okay, maybe we should pick one on this side. Okay,
we'll take
yes,
a few more questions.
Go ahead.
Okay.
The question is pricing during launch. It's especially important to me because I have a successful offline business that I'm taking online. But the overall question for all of us is any strategies about pricing during launch?
What do you price during launch? Well, you can probably guess. If you know your business, you know roughly what you should charge. So you should probably just go with whatever you'd guess. If you want to be more scientific about it, you could try talking to some potential users. Most of the time, you have some sort of tame users who are actual users but are also friends of yours or something like that, or family. And you can ask them, tell me honestly, like, what would you actually pay for this, right? You can always change your prices later, though. If you want to lower your prices, no one's going to complain. And if you want to raise your prices, you just grandfather your existing users, which if you have exponential growth will always be a tiny subset of your total users, and then no one will complain about that either. So don't sweat about it too much.
One way I think about that is it just seems like in the beginning, what you need more than anything is customers. And you want them to pay, so you need to pick a price that gets you customers. So you'll learn so much from those customers, and
definitely
you can
don't
change
overcharge,
later, right?
Don't lose
get
users
customers.
Over price. Yeah, because in the beginning you just want growth. Because the customers teach you. The first customers don't just give you money; they teach you.
All right, two more questions.
You pick two.
Okay, right up front here.
Angel investing. So my name's Karen and I'm with Chat Goose, and which is a chat manager. So three tips for dealing with and finding angel investors if you don't have, you know, the rich uncles, etc.
Well, we never talked about fundraising at all. Well, maybe I'll have to do this whole thing again.
That's good. Fundraising is a thing to occupy your thoughts as a founder is overrated. It's better not to be spending all your time thinking about fundraising.
And we come to it much later in the class, so we don't need to.
All right, so the question was how to find angel investors? Well, that's the thing. I'm particularly ill-suited to answering that question because Y Combinator is like this machine for funneling angel investors into all the startups that it accepts. So, like, how do you find angel investors if you don't? It's like asking a pilot how to, you know, walk along a track on the ground. I know the least about that.
Here's the thing. Angel investors are looking for you. So get out there. go to, I don't know. Well, there's lots of startup events. The angels are angels, like they're not necessarily good angels, but angels are out there looking. And the best way to actually meet angels is to get one to invest in you and then to introduce you to people they know.
Actually, I know the answer to this. I know the answer. Find people who work at startups and ask them to introduce you to their investors. That's the way to do it.
That's a good answer. Okay, last question, Paul. You get to choose, maybe from this side.
Right there.
There's a trend in the valley where companies are starting to hire people without college degrees. Are you guys thinking of going after high school students to fund?
Is YC thinking of going after high school students to fund? Well, I don't know, because I don't think on behalf of YC anymore, but you better not be, because that would be an evil thing to do. There are plenty of high school students who could start successful startups, but they shouldn't. Just because you could start a successful startup doesn't mean you should, because if you start a successful startup, like, that means, like, the footloose and fancy free days of your life are over, right? That, like, you're working for that company.
We have funded kids in high school, but only because they're already going. Like it's that we're not encouraging. Like, I agree. Like, to go to high school and encourage kids to, like, do this incredibly hard thing instead of having fun and like being kids, that's awful. I actually think that
it's premature optimization too, right? What you should be doing when you're in high school and even college is you should be figuring out what the options are,
right?
Not picking one option and running with it, right?
And, you know, it just turns out that usually people who are in school and stop to start companies, it's like, you know, there are dropouts from Harvard. We know the classic examples. But if you have, like, if you drop out and just go do it and it's you're on a path, that's one thing. But most people, like, they're dabbling and they have a fallback. And that's not a good way to be a startup founder. You have to be 100% committed. And so we'll fund people in college, maybe even high school, if they're already clearly 100% committed. Otherwise, no, whatever trend. I think that trend you're talking about is that you graduate from high school and why bother getting a college degree because you're already a fantastic hacker. So I'm going to hire you. And if that person wants to enter the professional workforce, well, that's great.
I don't know. It would have been good for me.
It wouldn't have been good for me either, but, you know.
To, like, go off and start some startup.
I do think between 18 and 22, you grow a lot as a human being who's human and humane. And it's not clear what society will turn into if all those folks enter the workforce.
It's good to, like, mess around and do a whole bunch of different things in your early 20s.
If you can afford it, yeah.
Whether this messing around and doing a whole bunch of things takes the form of college or something else, just, like, don't be careful, because, like, starting a startup is like catching a dragon by the tail if it works. Right? Like, be careful at what point in your life you do that.
Paul, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you, Jeff.